All right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. We got a very special guest today. We're going to talk about economics. But wait, wait, don't change the channel. The economics of beer. I know everybody got really hungover last night, and you're all just waking up and cracking open your first cold one of the morning. And so why not learn a little free market economics from the point of view of the beer industry? Our guest today is Dr. Glenn Whitman. He's the author of Strange Brew, Alcohol and Government Monopoly. Mr. Whitman is a research fellow at the Independent Institute in Oakland and assistant professor of economics at California State University at Northridge. He received his Ph.D. from NYU and has taught at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. Dr. Whitman is also a trustee of the American Parliamentary Debate Association and has written articles for many scholarly journals of law and economics. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what made you decide to write this book, Strange Brew?
Well, I've had a long-standing interest in government regulations that are designed to regulate people's sins, people's behavior that they choose to engage in on their own time. And so I was already interested in the issue of alcohol regulation and drug regulation and so on. And the Independent Institute approached me about possibly writing a policy report or a book on the subject of the monopoly protection laws in the alcohol industry. So that's how it started, and I started looking into it, and I found it a very interesting topic. The basic issue here is the fact that in virtually every state in the country, there are laws that shield alcohol distributors and alcohol wholesalers from their competition. And the result of that, just jumps straight to the bottom line, is that consumers, like you and me, end up facing higher prices and often for lower quality products. And that's just one of the typical results that you can expect to get when the government protects an industry against its competition.
Yeah, I noticed you called them alcohol industry monopoly protection laws. And I thought, well, that's a funny name for them. Surely that's not what they're called, are they?
No, that's not what they're called, at least by their defenders. Usually they're referred to as franchise termination laws. To understand why they're called that, you need to know a little bit about the structure of the alcohol industry. Basically, you have three sectors in the alcohol industry. You have the suppliers, meaning your vintners, your brewers, your wineries, and your importers, right? And they make the alcohol or bring the alcohol to the United States. Then you have your distributors or wholesalers, and they're sort of the middlemen. They take it from the suppliers, and then they take it to the final end, which is the retailers, meaning your restaurants and your liquor stores and so on, which actually sell the product to you, the customer. Now, the thing is that that's a pretty common structure in many industries, but it's usually not mandatory. But in the alcohol industry, it's mandatory. Because as a result of federal laws and a whole variety of state laws, the alcohol industry has to have those three sectors, and you have to have those middlemen. It's not legally possible in most cases for a supplier to sell directly to a consumer or directly to a retailer. All right. So what we're talking about here is this mandatory middleman sector and the kind of privileges it has. And essentially what these franchise termination laws do, the way they protect these wholesalers and distributors against their competition, is they turn their contracts with the suppliers into basically roach motels. All right, you can check in, but you can't check out. If a supplier makes a contract for the distribution of his product, say a particular type of beer, with a distributor, even after the contract is over, even after the specified term of the contract is finished, he can't actually get out of the contract. He's required by law to renew the contract. And he can't ever break the contract, even if it was the case that the distributor wasn't abiding by the terms of the contract, even if they weren't making their sales goals or whatever requirements are put into the contract. So essentially the result is that the suppliers and, the distributors or wholesalers can raise prices, and they can lower the quality of their efforts that they put into raising the value of the brand, and the supplier can't do anything about it once they've entered into the initial deal with them. And so that's how they're protected against their competition, because it makes it very, very difficult for the suppliers ever to find a new distributor or wholesaler. That's why they're called franchise termination. Actually, I guess I never explained why it's called franchise. Franchising is just a term which refers generally to these industry structures where you have a supplier and a distributor. So essentially the franchise is the distributor, and they're the ones who are protected.
So it's sort of like the deal at 7-Eleven or at a particular restaurant where you know, one restaurant will have all Pepsi products and another restaurant will have all Coke products, that kind of thing. Only you're saying once you get in that contract, you have to, you can't get out of it?
Yeah, it's very similar to that. I wouldn't say exactly, because there are differences here in the types of franchise we're talking about. They're sometimes what they call essentially brand name franchises, and that's where you think of something like a McDonald's or a Burger King or something like that. Franchising is actually a broader term that also includes anything where somebody else is doing your distribution for you, and so that's the kind of franchising here too. But you're very right and exactly on target with your analysis of effectively what it would be. It would be as though McDonald's made an agreement with Coke that they would serve Coke at some particular McDonald's locations, and then they were told by the government, oh, now that you've made a deal with Coke, you can't ever get out of it. You can't back out of it. Even at the end of the contract, you can't get out of it and go to dealing with Pepsi instead. That's the kind of thing that we're dealing with.
Wow, and so I wonder, what's the effect of that on, you know, if some local brew enthusiast decides to make his own beer and try to sell it down at the local Quickie Mart, how difficult is that to do?
Well, that's just straight out illegal, actually. In most states, that will be straight out illegal because of the fact that you're required to have this three-tiered structure to the alcohol industry. So suppose that you made your own new brew. You've got this new brew, and you would like to be able to sell it to consumers. Well, you could do it on the black market if you wanted, but if you wanted to do it through legal channels, you would have to get a distributor. You couldn't go straight to the liquor store and say, I want to sell my beer in your liquor store. All right? At least in most states. There are some states where perhaps you could, but in most states you couldn't. Instead, you would have to go to a distributor, and you say, I want you to distribute my beer for me. And then you make a contract with them, and then after that, you would be stuck in that contract with them. You would never be able to get out of that contract, at least with respect to the geographic area you're talking about. If you wanted to sell it somewhere else, you could get a new distributor for that area, but then you'd be stuck with them for that area, too.
So if someone could go to the grocery store and buy the ingredients and make the beer at their house and not have to deal with the distributor, they could sell it for, I'm guessing, approximately the same price as a regular six-pack of Busch Tall Boys, right?
I suppose. I guess it would depend on the quality. But, of course, legally they couldn't do that. But, yeah, if you went home and you did a home brew of your own and you wanted to try to sell it to your friends, I mean, I don't know how much your friends are going to be willing to pay for your own home brew. I don't know how good a brewer you are. But suppose that you came up with something good, right? Suppose that you actually had a talent for this and you came up with a really great new beer that you thought people would be willing to pay for. Just because of the structure of the industry, legally you would not be able to sell that in any kind of a broad-based fashion without going through a distributor.
Which then, if you don't start out owning all the farms that grow the hops and all that kind of thing, like Anheuser-Busch and giant companies like that, by the time a local homebrewer gets his stuff through all the middlemen and finally onto the shelf at the grocery store, now it's, what, $12 a six-pack or something? $8 or something unaffordable compared to the corporate
right.
producer.
I mean, I don't know if it's going to jump up that high, but it's certainly the case that the price could end up being higher than if you had just been able to sell it to the consumer directly or sell it to the liquor store directly. Instead, you have to sell it through a distributor, and the distributor, of course, does a markup. Right? So there's the price that you sell it to them for, they mark it up and sell it to the liquor store, and the liquor store marks it up once again. So by the time you reach the end, you've got two or three markups. All right? So naturally, the price is a lot higher than if you just sold it directly. But I don't want to sound like I'm saying that distributors are a bad thing. Right? Distributors can perform some very important functions. Right? Suppose that you've made your new home brew, right, and you'd like to sell it to people. But you don't know where to sell it. You know, you only know the two liquor stores that are within 5 miles of you, and that's all you know, right? One of the nice things about a distributor is that you can go to the distributor, and the distributor will often have a whole network built up of places where they would be able to sell your beer, right? So that's an advantage for you, and that's why even if we didn't have these laws, there probably would still be this three-tiered structure to the alcohol industry.
Well, it's the like problem with the laws, every product, right?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of products distributed that way. Right, absolutely. So I don't want to sound like I'm saying the wholesale sector is a bad thing that we don't want to have it. It's unnecessary. They are middlemen, but sometimes they're very useful middlemen. The problem is that we give them this privileged position where you don't even have the option of going around them. You don't even have the option of going directly to the liquor store if you want to. And then when you use them, you get locked into these long-term contracts with them that you can never escape. And so that's an undesirable situation because it means invariably you are going to be getting higher prices for your product when it comes to the final consumer being able to buy them.
I want to ask you about how they got all these laws passed in the first place, and I guess probably the easy answer is obviously that the big corporations that produce most of the beer in this country, you know, buy some congressmen and get these laws passed for their advantage, but it seems like they would have had to have some pressure from below also of people demanding that government regulate the alcohol industry for some benign purpose.
Yeah, well, there are different justifications for these things, and some of the justifications are real justifications, maybe ones that ultimately I disagree with or don't think are important. Other ones are what I call fig leaf justifications, which are sort of the justifications that people give to make it sound like their special interest legislation is in the public interest, but very often it's not, right? So as an example, you have the steel industry, and if the steel industry wants to be protected from competition abroad, they're not going to say, yeah, the reason we want these tariff barriers against foreign steel is so that we can make more money at the expense of the consumer, right? They're not going to say that. So what they're going to say instead is, we need to keep the steel industry in America for national defense or something like that, right? So that's what I call a fig leaf justification. It's a justification that's offered not because it's the real reason, but because it's the reason that sounds better in public. Right.
Well, were there any reasons put forward by, like, people who weren't actually, you know, fig leaf shills on behalf of the corporations, but actual, like, I think of the phrase from the days of Prohibition, the bootleggers and the Baptists got together to get Prohibition passed.
Yes, absolutely. So there are some, I think, real justification for these laws, although I don't think the justification is good enough. But there are certainly some honest justifications for the laws. One of them is just simply that a lot of this regulation that I'm talking about came about at the end of Prohibition. So at the end of Prohibition, they realized that it was a big failure, right? They realized it was a disaster. It had created crime. It really didn't reduce the amount of alcohol that people were drinking very much. And the alcohol they were drinking was a lot more dangerous because they were making it in their bathtubs and so on. So Prohibition was a great big disaster. They realized that. But at the same time, there was an understanding that at least a lot of communities and states might want to continue some version of Prohibition on their own. So the idea was to pass a repeal of Prohibition that allowed states to continue to regulate alcohol. And so that's what the 21st Amendment did. One of the main things that people disliked about the alcohol industry prior to Prohibition was the fact that there often were these, what they call tithe houses, which are essentially makers or suppliers of alcohol who are selling it directly to the consumers. And so what you'd get is a place like a bar, and the bar actually makes their beer and makes their liquor, and then they sell it to people directly. And naturally, in a system like that, it's going to be the case that they have every incentive to want to push their own alcohol, right? They want to encourage people to drink the product they're selling. And this was perceived as a bad thing by people who, you know, essentially the Puritan elements of the country that's opposed to any kind of promotion of drinking. All right. Now, that's not a justification I agree with, but I think it's an honest justification. There are people who do have a real problem from a moral standpoint or an ethical standpoint with the consumption of alcohol products. So I think they're coming from a real place of concern, although I don't think that they should be able to push their views on the rest of us. And the other justification is a bit more difficult to explain. But the idea is that it's supposed to protect the wholesalers from the suppliers. And the reason that might be necessary is this. Think about a McDonald's, right? If you think about a McDonald's, somebody gets a franchise with a McDonald's. So it's a small businessman. He decides he wants to open up a McDonald's. He makes a contract with the McDonald's Corporation to open up a McDonald's, right? Now, in doing that, he has to make a lot of investments in this place, and a lot of those investments are going to be oriented toward meeting the specific requirements that McDonald's has, because they want all their restaurants to be the same, right?
Sure.
Now, a lot of the benefit of that goes to McDonald's and not to the small businessman. The businessman gets the benefit of using the McDonald's name, but a lot of this money and investment that he's spending on this particular project goes to the benefit of McDonald's. He started up this whole McDonald's there and advertised it and got a lot of people used to the fact that there's going to be a McDonald's there, built up a customer base, and then suddenly McDonald's said, see ya, and they broke their contract with this guy, kicked the businessman out, and instead replaced him with one of their own guys and made this their own sort of corporate-run McDonald's. Well, clearly that small businessman would have gotten screwed over, right?
Sure. You wouldn't need laws really to protect that specifically. You just need laws to enforce his contract, right?
Well, and ultimately that's what I think about it, is that that is a real problem, but it's the kind of real problem that people deal with every day in every industry. And when you write a contract, you have to be thinking in advance, okay, are there opportunities for the other guy to take advantage of me as a result of this contract? And the people that we're talking about here are generally not stupid, particularly in the alcohol industry when we're talking about these distributors and wholesalers. These are often very big businesses with many, many years of experience. The notion that they are just going to be over a barrel when it comes to the contract negotiations with the suppliers is just simply not true. Even if that were true in other industries, and there may be other industries where that is closer to being true, in this case, typically we have one wholesaler who deals with many, many different suppliers of alcohol, you know, many different brewers, many different vintners. And so the result is that no one of those suppliers has any great degree of control or influence over that wholesaler. He has a great degree of freedom. If one of the suppliers decides to drop him as a distributor, he says, fine, he's still got 99 other products that he's going to be selling. So the truth is the amount of power that the suppliers have over the wholesalers is really not that great after all. So I don't think they need that much protection. And in any case, if they're worried about the protection, that's something they should deal with in the process of the writing of the contract. That's the appropriate place to deal with it. If they're worried about that concern, then they can write something into the contract that says the conditions under which it can be terminated and so on. And in fact, that's exactly what they do when these laws aren't in place.
So basically, it would be just a matter of simple common law, civil action, instead of particular regulations about this particular industry.
Right, that's exactly what it'd be. And the fortunate thing about that common law type approach is because contract law is relatively open to a variety of different types of provisions or solutions that they may come to, as opposed to the statutory law, which tends to be one size fits all. You end up passing one policy that is the conditions for the termination of a wholesaler's contract that applies to everybody instead of individuals being able to write their own contracts that fit their own particular situations and circumstances.
Let me make sure I understand you, Dr. Whitman, on the flow of power here. If I understand you correctly, the distributors are pretty much forbidden from breaking their contract with the suppliers, and the retailers are pretty much forbidden from breaking their contracts with the distributors, right? So the power flows from the suppliers down to the retailers?
I wasn't talking specifically about the contracts between the wholesalers and the retailers, although those also exist. I'm talking about the contracts that are between the suppliers and the wholesalers.
I understand that just now you're referring to that, but I mean talking about how hard it is to break the contracts, you're talking originally about how the retailer can't really break his contract with the distributor, and then I think you just referred to the distributor has a hard time breaking his contract with the brewer, right?
Right. Actually, it's generally the reverse. What these laws do is they make it difficult for the supplier to get out of the contract with the wholesaler. All right? So, say I'm a supplier of beer. I'm a brewer, right? I get into a contract with a wholesaler to distribute my beer in a particular geographic area, Austin. All right? And then, at the end, suppose that contract says that it's going to last for 5 years. All right? So, for the next 5 years, he's going to be my distributor. All right? Then, at the end of 5 years, according to that contract, the contract's over. If he wants to continue being my distributor, he should have to do another contract with me. But the problem is the law prevents me as the supplier from going to a different distributor. Instead, I'm required to continue dealing with him even though our contract's over. All right? Or another thing that could happen is suppose that he breaks the terms of my contract. He's my wholesaler. He's my distributor. He's supposed to deliver my products in a particular way. For instance, we may agree that he's supposed to deliver them in a proper refrigerated truck. All right, so it's always supposed to be refrigerated in the whole process of delivery. Suppose he stops doing that. Suppose he starts slacking off and his refrigerators and his trucks aren't working and so on. As a result, people are getting skunky beer, right? Now, naturally, I don't want this guy as my wholesaler anymore because he's making my products lower quality. But what am I going to do about it? Well, I should be able if he's broken the terms of my contract, either to hold him to it or to say, okay, at this point the contract's over because of the fact that he violated the terms, particularly if that's what our contract said to begin with. But again, here's where the government comes in. The government says, I can't break that contract, right? I can't get out of it, even though we specifically said in the contract he had to meet these requirements. He didn't meet these requirements, and the contract is supposed to be over when he chooses not to meet the requirements. So does that make more sense to you now?
Sure, and the retailer has the same problem, right? If he keeps getting the beer warm and it's supposed to get to him cold, he can't really get out of the contract with the distributor either. So really the distributors have the upper hand over the suppliers and the retailers.
Quite possibly, although that other end of the transaction between the distributors and the retailers is not as regulated. Most of these laws that I'm talking about deal with the relationship between the supplier and the distributor, not the relationship between the distributor and the retailer. So there's not as much of a problem there. I wouldn't be surprised if there were laws like these also affecting that relationship, but they're not as common and they're not as much of a problem.
Okay, well, how am I to understand when I see particular distributing companies that seem to be totally under one supplier? Like there will be a distributing company that only distributes Budweiser and
right.
and don't distribute for anybody else. Is that a case of the supplier having the upper hand over them?
Arguably, that's going to be a situation in which the supplier does have a greater amount of control because of the fact that if they pull out, right, if they decide to drop the contract at the end of the contract term, then the wholesaler is in a position where all of his business is gone, right? So say you are Budweiser, I'm your Budweiser distributor, you and I enter a deal, I'm going to distribute Budweiser for 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, I spent a long time building up the business and everything, but you choose not to renew my contract, and as a result, I'm sort of left out in the cold. And that's exactly the type of situation that is used as a justification for these laws in question. However, I don't think it's a sufficient justification because, of course, who is the distributor in this situation, me or you? I can't remember in my example.
Oh, was I the distributor?
I was the distributor? Okay, great. So I'm the distributor, and I know at the time that I'm signing this contract with you, your Budweiser, I know in the contract it says 5 years. I know the contract's going to be up in 5 years, and therefore I know that it's a possibility that I'll be left out in the cold 5 years from now. I'm not stupid. I know I should take that into account when I decide to enter into this relationship in the first place, right? And so if I think that's going to be an issue, I could lobby to get a line put into this contract that says something like, if you decide not to continue my contract after 5 years, then in that case you're going to have to indemnify me by buying some of the particular investments that I've made. Say I've got a bunch of trucks that now say Budweiser on the side. Now you've got to buy my Budweiser trucks, right? So we could put stuff into the contract to deal with that particular possibility. And so the contract itself, once it's signed by both sides, represents a kind of meeting of the minds, what the both parties consider to be acceptable. And neither party would enter the contract if they considered themselves to be worse off as a result of the contract than they would be without it, right? That's one of the results of voluntary contract, is that you're only going to get the contract when both parties consider themselves better off.
Sure. So really all of this ends up with the effect for the local beer drinker that he's drinking worse beer and he's paying too much for it.
Exactly. That's the bottom line. That's really the bottom line of this whole thing. Now, there are some other justifications that are offered for this. Usually when people are trying to defend these kind of laws, they don't want to admit that these laws raise the price to consumers and lower the quality, right? But there are some who are willing to defend it on those terms. There are some who will say, essentially, Whitman, you're right. It is the case that these laws end up raising the price of beer and other alcohols. But then they say, but that's a good thing. They say that's a good thing because of the fact that we want alcohol to cost more so people will drink less of it. And so this is where we start to get into that kind of fiscalistic justification that we were talking about earlier. There are those who would like to restrict the drinking of alcohol, who would like people to have less of it. And so they're willing to use whatever kind of laws they can in order to get to that result. I'll say this, though. I think this is, again, in many cases, a fig leaf justification, all right? Because there are those groups out there that really do genuinely think that the price of beer and other alcohol should be higher. And then the other groups, specifically the special interests, the wholesalers and distributors who are trying to get themselves protected, they're willing to get behind that kind of justification, the paternalistic justification, not because they believe it. For goodness sake, they're selling alcohol. It's not like they think that people shouldn't be drinking it, right? But they're willing to sort of get behind that kind of justification because of the fact that it will help them to be able to get laws passed that end up protecting them from competition, right? So they'll say that.
Cases of that where we know that the alcohol industry was paying these groups?
Oh, absolutely. Well, not paying the groups. It's not, I'm not saying that they get behind it in the sense that, say, the distributors are funding the National Baptist Convention or something like that. But what it is that they adopt the justification, right? So if there are those who are out there making these arguments for why it is that the price of alcohol should be higher in order to deter people from drinking so much of it, then the distributors and the wholesalers' lobbying organizations will say the same thing. They will parrot the lines that these other groups are saying about the need for the price of alcohol to be higher, right? So sometimes you'll get that kind of them adopting the justifications of others as a means of trying to persuade legislators to pass laws that protect them from their competition.
If you don't mind, Dr. Whitman, I'd like to bring it more to the local level and bring up, like, the, for example, here in Texas, the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission. The average Quickie Mart clerk and probably especially a Quickie Mart owner here in town, and I'm sure all the bartenders, are basically scared to death of the TABC. And, you know, I hear stories all the time of, you know, the Quickie Mart clerk is bribing them with free porn if they'll just leave them alone, and they send in underage girls that look old enough to try their best to flirt with the clerk and get him to sell beer so they can entrap him. And there's even been cases here in Austin, Texas, where the TABC and the local police department were going into bars and arresting people for public intoxication in the bar where they're drinking. And, and I just wondered if your book really covers that angle where, like, this ends up like some sort of Prussian total state in the name of protecting us from alcohol, which is perfectly legal.
Right. That's not a main topic of the book, although I think you'll find that it's sort of one of the subsidiary themes in the book, which is that at least part of the justification for the kind of laws that I'm talking about and that are the primary focus of the book does come from the same source as the activities that you're talking about. And that there is sort of an anti-alcohol mentality out there. It's the same kind that led to prohibition in the first place. And so there are those who are quite happy to use the apparatus of the state whenever they can to restrict the consumption of alcohol. And so that's what we're seeing in those cases. But no, that kind of activity is not the main thing that I'm talking about in the book in any way. But I'm perfectly happy to talk more about it if you want.
It's like that in California. Do they arrest people for being drunk in a bar?
I'm sure there's been talk about it.
To entrap the poor Quickie Mart clerk?
I'm sure there's been talk about it, but I certainly haven't encountered it myself. I haven't seen it happening. There doesn't seem to be that same level of fear. Actually, I grew up in Texas, and now I live in California, so I can kind of compare. And it's really interesting how different it is, actually. California has a fairly permissive attitude toward alcohol, I found, which is very different from its attitude toward cigarettes, but that's another subject. But you can buy alcohol pretty much anywhere here. I go into drugstores, and in the drugstores, there are entire aisles filled with alcohol here. Whereas in other states that I've gone to, the only place you can buy alcohol is from the state-run liquor store, for instance, in a place like, I think, Virginia is like that.
Right, so, we were just talking about how in Alabama, that's the only place you can buy alcohol at all is from a state bureaucrat.
Right. Those are what are known as the control states. So basically, after Prohibition ended, there were a handful of states, I think about 18 or 19 of them, that became what we call control states. And essentially what they did is they monopolized the entire distribution in the hands of the state itself. So the state is responsible for the distribution and sometimes even the retailing of alcohol products. So those are the most controlled states.
Yeah,
but that's certainly not the case.
It brings up images to me of, like, you know, if two beer executives meet at the local diner for breakfast Saturday morning and they secretly decide to fix the price of alcohol, well, then they're criminals. They won't go to jail, but they'll at least pay a fine. But if they have that same breakfast meeting on Saturday morning and
with
they invite a couple of congressmen along and they set the price. Well, now that's all just fine and good because, after all, it's the law, and as long as the price fixing flows from the state, then that's fine and dandy, correct?
Right. And, well, what you're talking about is actually what's sometimes called the capture theory of government bureaucracy. The idea is that it's very often the case that bureaucracies that are formed at the state or federal level, whose alleged purpose is to regulate an industry, actually end up being a tool of the industry. And in fact, you'll often find that the industry supported the creation of that bureaucracy precisely because they could use that bureaucracy as a tool for price setting that would be immune from antitrust laws. And that turns out to be true even from the very, very beginning of the regulatory state. At the federal level, the very first regulatory agency, as we know it today, was the Interstate Commerce Commission, which is supposed to regulate the railroads. And surprisingly, the railroads, as it turns out, the ones who were supposed to be regulated by the ICC, were instrumental in getting the ICC passed, or the Interstate Commerce Act passed, which created the ICC, and then they were integrally involved in the regulations that were being passed by the ICC. And it turns out that the ICC, for the most part, was acting like a kind of cartel, and they were helping the railroads to be able to set non-competitive prices, which is something that they have never been able to succeed in doing on their own when they tried to create cartels, because somebody would always cheat on the arrangement. So essentially what they did is they got the government to do for them what they couldn't do for themselves, which is to create a price-setting cartel.
So that's really the origin of the regulatory state in the first place, was Morgan and Vanderbilt and the boys.
Something like that. I don't know if Vanderbilt himself was actually involved in that process. In general, Vanderbilt, if you look at his perspective, Vanderbilt is actually one of those guys that we look back on and we call a robber baron, but the more I look at him, the more I find out about him, the more I think of him as kind of a free market hero. Because there were many cases in which the state tried to even take over his railroad, and he fought them tooth and nail and sometimes put his whole fortune on the line in order to prevent the state from taking over his operation. But in any case, it's certainly the case that the railroad corporations toward the end of the 1800s, were involved and complicit in the creation of the first regulatory agency. That's true.
And it really was the same all the way through the 20th century, right, with the Federal Reserve Act and the New Deal and...
I don't want to make any broad statements that I couldn't support in particular cases, so I don't want to say that every regulatory agency that we've ever had has always been captured by the industry it was supposed to regulate. But I am willing to make the statement that that has often been the truth, that has very often been the case. And it was certainly true with the very first of the regulatory agencies, that being the ICC. It also turns out to be the case if you look at the state level. We're not just talking about federal bureaucracy, but also state bureaucracy. Often it'll turn out, for instance, that the State Insurance Commission, effectively ends up passing regulations that shield insurance companies from potential upstart insurance companies that might want to compete with them. Or if you look at licensing regulations, the various licensing boards, for doctors and cosmeticians and electricians and plumbers and so on. One of the main purposes of these boards is to make sure that they don't have as much competition as they would otherwise have. So cosmeticians make sure that people who haven't taken years and years of training in haircutting, possibly in techniques that they never even are going to use, are not going to be able to enter the industry and compete with them and hence push down their prices. The result of that, of course, is that consumers end up paying more for haircuts or for electrical services or for plumbing services or whatever product or service it is that we're talking about. So it's a really, really common phenomenon to see the apparatus of the state sort of co-opted for the purposes of the industry that it was supposed to regulate.
Well, so what if the argument in general about the excesses of capitalism must be contained by regulation and that, the economy and the boom and bust cycle and the people who would go and give everybody a terrible haircut if they didn't have proper training and the excesses of people seeking profit and how they must be contained by the government. You reject
right.
that?
Yeah, I would say in general, as a general proposition, I reject that. I would not put myself in the camp that says the market is always wonderful, the market always produces the very best outcome. Rather, I'm in the camp of people who say, look, we have to compare, all right? The market does some things well, and it does other things not so well, all right? But the same is also true of government. And so if we look at a market and we see an outcome that we don't like very much, and then we just conclude that the government should regulate it, we're not doing good analysis. We're not thinking clearly, because we have to realize that even if the market's bad, the government might be worse, and very often is. There's an old story about a king who was supposed to judge a beauty contest, and there were only two finalists. There were two finalists in the beauty contest, and he was supposed to choose between them. And so they brought out the first one, and she was so hideously ugly that he immediately declared the second one the winner, sight unseen. Well, obviously that doesn't make sense, right? You have to look at both. She might have been even uglier. And the same thing goes when we're comparing to governments to markets. You need to look at the market, and you might see some imperfections, things you don't like about the market, but then compare it to the government outcome, and you'll often realize that the government outcome would be substantially worse, especially when it does, when there's the possibility of a regulatory capture. So whatever things you thought were bad about the market turn out to be even worse in the context of a government agency with the power of the state behind it that is under the control or the influence of that industry.
Makes good sense to me. No wonder you let me look at the official title again. No wonder you're a research fellow at the Independent Institute.
That's something I became entitled just by the very fact that I wrote this particular monograph, actually. But
it is something that right I... In.
I'm sorry?
You seem to fit right in.
they have good folks working there, and I generally agree with them on a lot of stuff. But it's these are things that I care about, and I think that it's very easy for people to get misled by essentially the kind of anti-corporate or anti-market propaganda that's often thrown around. You have to question whether the regulations that are being advocated for a particular purpose really serve that purpose. I think a lot of people will hear a regulation and they'll say, what was the purpose of the regulation? And the answer will be, well, it had this great purpose, and they'll outline some good purpose that it was supposed to accomplish. And some people stop there. They'll say, oh, okay, that's a good purpose. I'm in favor. And you just can't stop there. You have to ask, all right, is that the real purpose? And does it actually serve that purpose? And does it have any disadvantages that we should know about? And quite often it turns out the official purpose was just a fig leaf purpose, and that really there was something much more nefarious going on. And often it'll turn out that it creates disadvantages that overcome any advantage you get from the serving of whatever that purpose was. So you need to be careful in thinking about these things.
Should there be any regulation of the alcohol industry? How would you have it set up if you were the most powerful lobbyist in America and you could go around all the states and convince them to set their alcohol laws right? How would you do it?
I would still have regulation purely for the purpose of trying to keep excessive drinking out of the hands of children. I think that's a reasonable thing for the state to be doing. Although I think there are actually, I could probably be persuaded in the other direction on that one as well. There's some very good arguments about how actually our current attitude toward age and alcohol just creates binge drinking. You know, people suddenly reach the age of 21 and decide they're going to binge because they've never learned responsible attitudes toward alcohol from their parents at their dinner table, right?
There are nodding in this room right now.
but at least on its surface, I'd be willing to say I think that there's a reasonably strong argument, although not a definitive argument, for some form of age regulation, even if it's not 21. The 21 drinking age, I don't think, can be justified on any level. But, you know, even if it were just something like 16, I think that could possibly be justified. Beyond that, I think that the alcohol industry should be subject to the same kinds of minimal regulations that I think should be applied to all industries, which means, of course, their contracts are actually going to be enforced, all right? If they sell defective products that they haven't warned people about sufficiently to know that there's a potential of harm, then they can be sued in court. They can be charged with having, created product liability. And so I think all of that would be reasonable. Beyond that, I think we need to have severe penalties for people who abuse alcohol. So if we're talking about drunk drivers, or are we talking about intoxicated criminals, people who become abusive or violent under the influence of alcohol, those people need to be dealt with very severely, or else we have the possibility that the consumption of alcohol will create great externalities on the rest of the people in society. So I think it's reasonable to for a government to be restricted to this rather narrow role of trying to control the negative impact that alcohol may have on other people, the people who have not, in fact, consumed the alcohol itself. I don't think the government has any business in trying to protect people from themselves, though. If I choose to drink alcohol and damages my liver, I think ultimately that's my own business, and the government should stay out of that decision.
Well, what about if someone drives drunk and they get all the way home without so much as bumping a curb? Is that still a crime?
That's a good question. In general, there are a couple of different ways to deal with risk-creating activity, right? You can think of, what if I take a gun and I try to shoot you, but I fail, right? And the bullet whizzes past your head instead and lodges in a wall, so I haven't done any damage to you. I think we'd probably agree that I'd still committed some kind of a crime, and it would be a good thing for me to be punished for trying to kill you, even if I didn't succeed in killing you or even in injuring you, right? We call it attempted murder, right? So attempted murder, punishing people for attempted murder is punishing them even though they may have created no damage whatsoever, but they created a great risk of damage to others, right? And I think most people would consider that acceptable. And so I know that there are some people who would argue that maybe we shouldn't be punishing drunk driving because unless they've actually hurt somebody, you know, only punish after the fact. But I disagree with that point of view. I think we should be punishing that as well, but I also think it's a good idea to punish the people who are actually driving around, you know, two-ton vehicles at high speeds and risking others' lives, even if somehow through just the luck of the throw of the dice, they manage not to hurt other people. So I do think it is a reasonable and good thing for the state to do to punish drunk drivers as well, and not just those who have actually caused harm, but who have just created risk.
So the intent on the part of you trying to shoot me, and the lack of intent on the part of someone who's trying to drive home and get there in one piece, that doesn't really make the difference to you?
Well, okay, I could modify the example if you wanted to. Like, what if I wasn't trying to kill you? What if I was just sort of, you know, running around in my front yard, you know, firing my gun recklessly because I like the sound of it and I enjoy firing my gun, and a bullet whizzes past your head, right? I'm doing it in a reckless fashion. I'm creating a danger to you. And I think we can say, look, we don't just punish people for actually physically harming people, but also we also punish them for threatening people, right? If you create undue risks to other people, that's also unacceptable, even if you just happen to get lucky. I'm inclined to say, look, we're not going to give you a free pass just because of the fact that you got lucky. There is still some kind of punishment to be done. Now, you may make a relevant point on intent in terms of how much punishment or what type of punishment we're going to be giving to a person who commits that. So if I deliberately tried to kill you, I'm inclined to think I should be suffering a greater punishment than if I were just being an idiot and firing off my gun and a bullet went by your head. So, I think intent matters in that sense.
The only thing that's throwing me off is I can hear the gun control people and the prohibitionists of alcohol arguing that you having that gun in the first place, ooh, especially if you were drunk at the time, is already putting you in a position where you could be reckless danger to myself or to somebody else. That if you get drunk at the bar and your car's parked outside, well, that's only one step from driving that car, which is only one step from crashing it into somebody.
Right. And I think if they argue it in those terms, they'll have a better argument than they have, you know, the usual arguments that they make. I still think they're mistaken, though. And the reason I think they're mistaken is in the case where I've already fired my gun in a sort of random fashion, after that, sort of the bullet's out of my control. It's already heading in your direction. All right? In the case where I'm getting drunk in the bar, I still have a subsequent decision to make, all right? It's not just, you know, sometimes the stories we tell about it, the way these folks make their stories, it's so when you're drunk, you never make a decision, that you're just a robot, an automaton, who just goes off and does random things that you would never do if you were sober and so on. But I think there's a subsequent choice to be made, right? I get drunk on alcohol, even if I do that at home, not a bar, I'm at home. There's a chance that I might choose to go down to go and sit in my car and drive somewhere, right? But the point is, it's not just a chance of a bad thing happening to other person. It's a chance of my choosing to do something, and it's the choice that I think is really relevant. Have I chosen to take an action that actually creates a risk to another person that I cannot then mitigate? Does that make sense?
Right, sure. I'm just thinking, I'm trying to apply the same argument to other things like domestic violence, for example, and how most domestic violence in America, I'm sure, is the result of drunk husband beating the wife, right?
Actually, I've heard statistics arguing otherwise. The best statistics I've seen says something like maybe 60% of domestic violence is man beating woman, and 40% is the other way around. But
well, that's good to know that. Getting some
women are equal opportunity offenders.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Well, yeah, and don't get me wrong, because I'm barely ever for prior restraint in any case, and I think I'm with you on the drunk driving thing, but I can just see the logic being attempted at least to be taken further, you know?
Right. Well, I think it's reasonable for us to have that debate. You know, if somebody comes to me and they make an argument about the control of alcohol-related damage, and they put it in the terms that you did, where they're essentially making an argument about the rational calculation of risks to other people, that's at least a debate that I'm willing to have, and I think it's a debate that we should have. Ultimately, I think they're mistaken. I think it's going to be more effective, for the most part, for us to be punishing the direct creation of risk or the direct creation of harm to others, but at least I'm willing to entertain that argument and think about it carefully. The arguments that I don't take anywhere near as seriously are the ones that that essentially put the argument in terms of protecting me from myself or in terms of encouraging moral behavior or something to that effect. Those are arguments that I can't take very seriously in a free society. I would also say this, that you always have to ask, is this the real argument or is this the fig leaf? Because it's very often the case that you get special interests trying to use these particular arguments made by particular groups that may seem like serious arguments, but really it's just cover for the fact that they're trying to create a monopoly for themselves. And I think that's what we have in this case. Take this case. All right, let's bring this back to alcohol because it's a really good application. All right, what if we agreed with the anti-alcohol folks that it would be a good idea to raise the price of alcohol? All right. Suppose we agree that we should raise the price of alcohol in order to reduce the amount of drinking that took place, in order to reduce the amount of drunk driving and other alcohol-related accidents. Right?
Okay.
What if we agreed with them? Would we think that creating these monopoly protection laws of the kind that I've been talking about here in my book, would we think that that was a wise way of dealing with that problem? It would be much simpler and more direct just to tax the product, just to put a tax on the alcohol. Right? It's very easy to administer that, and then as a result of it, the state's going to be collecting the money, and that's actually revenue for the state, all right, that they can use for whatever purpose, including possibly compensating victims.
Well, and it's right? Not hidden either. You can see the tax in plain view, and you know you're paying it.
Exactly. So it's transparent. On the other hand, the kind of laws that I'm talking about, most people aren't even aware of them. All right, I hadn't thought about them that much myself before I started to do the research on this project, right? I imagine you hadn't heard it. I imagine most of your listeners had not heard of these particular laws, and yet we're all being affected by them, and we're all paying higher prices for alcohol as a result of them, all right? And who's getting all the benefits? All of these benefits are going to the wholesalers and distributors who have this protected position. Moreover, it is virtually impossible to control with these laws the actual size of the increase in the price, right? With a tax, you can decide, okay, we're going to have a tax of $1 or $1.50 or $1.75, right? The amount of the rise in price as a result of these laws is pretty much not under any control of the state. We can't decide what is the right amount to put as the increase in the price, because it's simply not under the control. They just passed the law. So even if we agreed that we wanted to increase the price of alcohol, this would quite possibly be the stupidest, most irrational policy that we could possibly pick for doing so, right? And so the fact that some people are willing to defend these laws on those terms should be a clue to us that really their goal is not the goal of trying to decrease the amount of drunk driving in society, but in fact it's one of trying to enrich a special interest.
Absolutely. Everybody, Dr. Glenn Whitman, the author of Strange Brew, Alcohol, and Government Monopoly. Thank you so much for coming on the air today, sir.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.